Well, how many of you enjoyed yesterday's weather? Spring arrived. I'm sorry it had to get away so quick, but at least you got to enjoy it for a day. Our family got to sit outside and grill out and just enjoy the weather. And then I got the notice on my phone that says, it'll be 25 degrees colder tomorrow. I'm like, well, at least we had one spring day before April, right? It was good. It was good. Well, a couple of things I just want to mention. This week we had the privilege of, I had the privilege of meeting someone who's going on a mission trip. He's related to Max Darnell. It's his brother, and the brother was willing to acknowledge he knew Max, so that was nice. Max isn't here for me to pick on, but Max is not here for him to defend himself. Oh, no, he's in the back. He moved. Okay, good. Good to see you, Max. Anyway, I got to meet his brother, and his brother goes on these mission trips. And so I just want you to know that you are a part of this. The monies we collect, go to the general operating budget. We also have some missions funds, and his particular project was not in our scope. But when it's presented to us, we look for somebody to help. What he's been doing, he travels with a team of about four guys, and right now, in July, they're going to Colombia to hand Bibles to those who are refugees coming out of Venezuela. If you've been following anything in Venezuela, it's a horrific situation, politically and all the upheaval, and people are trying to escape just so they can get medical care and food and just what they need, but ultimately they need the gospel. So we were able to contribute $1,000 towards this mission as they're going to go down and hand out Bibles to every person who comes across the border and pray with them and try to help and minister to them. So you are a part of that. So thank you for your faithful giving in that. Because when those opportunities come up, I want to make sure we've got funds to be able to meet the needs. There's one thing I need you to do at the end of the service. Currently, you're sitting on the carpet that's been here 20-plus years. It will not be here after today. If you need to shed a tear, go ahead. We'll have a moment of silence. Okay? I know some of you are still crying about the missing orange shag carpet that was here before that. So we may still have some sample pieces around if you need to smell it or something. All right, so at the end of the service, what we're going to do, we're going to prepare this place because tomorrow morning they're going to come up and rip up all this carpet and replace it. And under where your feet are sitting now, there's going to be more of a wood, I don't know if it's tile or whatever it is. They're going to put that look underneath you. So we need to actually take the Bibles out of the pews so when they take up the pews, they won't have anything falling out. So I'm just going to ask, there's only a few pews or Bibles on your pew. If you would just make sure you take that out as you walk out, put it on a silver tray that's in the back. That would just save me some time from having to do that after the service. So if you just do that for me. But what you can do, if you don't have a Bible with you, open up the Bible, and then we can get started on what we're going to talk about. But thank you if you'd help me with that, and I'll try to remember to remind you at the end of the service to do that for me. We've had a lot of stuff going on in the church. Certainly we've had some roof problems here. Those are all now fixed. So that's a good thing. In the midst of fixing this roof, we discover we have roof problems in the children's building. That is now all fixed. And once we get the carpet done, I think we're going to be done without any unexpected things. I think we'll be done with all four buildings that we've done some modifications on over the years, sometimes based on flooding, sometimes based on other mishaps, but all of it will be completed. Thank you. So anyway, turn in your Bibles, if you will. We're going to continue on with our Find Strength in God. And I want you to turn, if you've got a red Bible in front of you and you want to use that one, turn to page 370. We're going to work with 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 9. But to lead up to that, I want to introduce you to somebody else. Each week I've been introducing you to somebody. Grover Cleveland one week, Charles Brush, the electrician guy. And so today we're going to deal with 2 Chronicles 16, 9. But I want to introduce you to a lady named Mabel. Her name is Mabel. I'll make sure I get it right. Yeah, Mabel Francis. We have her. Yeah, we've got her up on the screen. Let me tell you about Mabel. Anybody know who Mabel Francis is, by the way? Never heard of her. And that's a shame. I know there's some great people in the. I love reading biographies and autobiographies when I get an opportunity. And so Mabel Francis was an American missionary. She worked with the Christian and Missionary Alliance. She was raised in New Hampshire, but she traveled to Japan in 1909. She labored through World War I, during the Great Depression of our country, where the funds were coming from here to help support her. Times got very difficult for her. but she stayed there in Japan. She headed into the challenging years of World War II, living in Japan, who had attacked Pearl Harbor in the United States. She was in her 60s when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. She wanted to stay in Japan to spread the peace and loving message of Jesus Christ. As the war worsened, she was placed under house arrest. Over the years, she earned the respect of local police and government officials, who then treated her with respect. Mabel turned her home into a small hospital and served as a nurse to all those who needed her help. Unfortunately, the day came when she was taken to a prison camp, which she was held in this large building somewhere in Tokyo. The conditions were pretty poor. The food was even worse, and some days there was no food at all. Her health was deteriorating in her aging years. Towards the end of the war, the Allies began bombing Tokyo, and every single night she would hear the B-29 bombers fly overhead, unleashing death throughout the city. One night, a bomb destroyed the building that was right next to where she was being held. And the fire began to spread to her building and others. So the prisoners were thrown out of the building into the streets in the open air. They were attempting to avoid being scorched by fire or being hit by flying debris everywhere. It was a very scary moment for her and those around. She was surrounded by death and suffering. There were broken men, weeping women, orphaned children throughout the streets running for their lives. In her autobiography, she described those difficult days. She said that the city was in ruins, her body was weak, undernourished, and exhausted. Pain pressed in from every side. She had no money. She was desperate and destitute. The one thing that she had left was her faith in God and the Bible that reminded her of Him. She opened the Bible. And she writes in her autobiography, God gave me the promise of 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 9. Let me read that verse for us. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless toward Him. The verse has some continual thoughts, but this is the portion that she seized onto. She writes, the eyes of the Lord, He knows just where the money is and where our help is coming from. This was to be our source of strength all through these difficult days. One miracle after another followed. This is what she writes. And going through the difficult days of living as an American in Japan during the World War, she had no resources of her own. The country had fallen apart, and certainly she was not going to be embraced overall. But where is she going to find her strength? Where is she going to find her hope? It's only through the Word of God, knowing that God is the one who looks to and fro. He's looking everywhere for hearts that are fully committed to Him. Not fully resourced, just hearts fully committed, because God would be her resource. So every day as she would get up, she doesn't know where all the help's going to come from other than God is going to provide a means for her to continue her ministry. And based on her own testimony, her greatest ministry was not pre-war, it was post-war. When there was a brokenness among all the people, and they were searching for hope and help. And this 65-plus-year-old woman did not give up, even though she was in physical trouble in many ways. Other biographers have described her incredible post-war ministry. They say that revival broke out where she was. Another local pastor in a church began reaching throughout the city. American GIs, who were strong evangelicals at the time, came and helped her efforts. Mabel even went to Hiroshima, where the atomic bomb had gone off, and she led people to Christ who had survived that attack. One woman in the area had lost her home and her two children and was severely burned from head to toe. She went to a gathering, a meeting that Mabel was holding at the time, and she came and listened to everything that Mabel said. And after meeting her and hearing the gospel, she says, quote, "Tonight you told us of God's love and that it was He who created us. I believe it. I believe it. My heart is comforted. Light has come to me." I never understand why God allows certain things in history and throughout countries, but what I do know is He can use all things for good for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Mabel never desired or ever could imagine what would have taken place in the country she had been ministering to for 40 years. But she used the opportunity to share the gospel, and there were people who came to Christ that otherwise perhaps may not have. Mabel brought hope and healing to a nation that was broken, and 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9, was her strength. Like every one of the verses that we're focused on each week, that verse comes in a context. It's written to a specific time and a specific people for a specific purpose. There's applications throughout every generation, but let's go back and see, why was this verse written and to whom it was written? You see that in verse 9 in chapter 16, but I want you to go back to chapter 14. If you're in the Red Bible, it's just one page over. We're going to learn a little bit about what's leading up to this. There's a man named Asa that we're going to learn about, and his life is captured in these three chapters, 14, 15, and 16. But in verse 1, you're going to see Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him at the city of David. This is verse 1. And Asa, his son, reigned in his place. Well, Abijah is the father of Asa, who we'll learn about today. Understanding in the timeline of all the kings, and they were the kings of Judah. All right, understanding a little Israel history, Israel was basically one big nation, but they were divided up into 12 components, if you will, 12 states, if you will, to understand it. There were 10 of them that were considered the northern tribes, the tribes that were considered Israel. There were two tribes in the south region where Jerusalem was, and it was known as Judah, but it was really Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin was so small that they just kind of got lumped up into Judah. So you have two southern tribes known as Judah and 10 northern tribes known as Israel. And there was a division after the time of Solomon where they were not on the same team. There was kind of a split, and they would even fight against one another at times throughout history. So we're talking about Asa today, and he's part of the southern tribes who are going to be protecting Jerusalem and the outlying areas. Well, Abijah is his father. Abijah's father was Rehoboam. Rehoboam's father was Solomon, and Solomon's father was David, King David. So David, Solomon, Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, and there are many more kings after that. So we're fairly early in the kingdom. Abijah grew up and grew up mighty. This is the father of Asa. He took 14 wives and had 22 sons and 16 daughters. Wow. But this is what it says in 1 Kings about Asa's father, who only reigned for 3 years. Most of the kings reigned for 40 plus years. He only had 3 years. It says in 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 3, "And he walked in all the sins that his father did before him, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father." So then, as he dies in his third year of the reign, then Asa takes over as king. Asa grows up in a home that was not godly. He did not have a father who taught him the truth of God and what it says in the scriptures. They did not spend time reading the law of Moses. So he's not involved in a Christian school. He's not involved in going to Sunday school every Sunday. He didn't have that surrounding. But there was enough in the community of Judah that he learned something along the way. But the primary lesson he learned is, I do not want to be like my sinful father. Though he didn't lead me in the right direction, I have a choice. I have a responsibility as an individual to do what is right. So if you will, he rebels against the sin of his father and says, I'm going to reign and rule differently. Here's one of the things you need to consider. No matter how you grow up, it does not mean you have to be that way. You don't have to continue to follow in the footsteps of your family if they are not living according to God's ways. You are held personally responsible for your life before God. You can't die and say, well, I grew up in a bad family. This is the reason I live so sinfully. God's going to say, yeah, but what about you? Because I don't have grandchildren. I only have children. And children are the ones who decide to follow me. What have you done about that? Every one of us need to make a personal decision about what we're going to do with the Lord Jesus Christ and God the Father. Are we going to follow him with our whole heart, mind, and strength? Or are we going to just follow in the footsteps of sinful people who were before us? No excuses. And so Asa looks at his father and says, I'm not going to be that way. And he was blessed with 41 years of reigning the kingdom. Let me tell you more about him as we look down here. It says in the end of verse 1, in his days, the land had rest for 10 years. That's a great way to start your kingdom. As I step in, I've got 10 years of no wars. Everything was good, no famines. Verse 2, and Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. Totally opposite of a sinful father. He took away the foreign altars and the high places and broke down the pillars and cut down the Asherim. Based on the Asherah pole, it was a female goddess of fertility whom the Israelites, the people living in Judah, the Jewish people, began to worship foreign gods. And they had erected all of these things. And when Asa steps in and says, this isn't right. If we're going to say we're people of God, we need to get rid of the things that are a part of the false gods. Let's stop having distractions in our culture. Let's break them down. Let's remove them. You know, when a nation has godly leaders who understand a moral baseline, they know right from wrong, according to Judeo-Christian principles, the nation will be blessed and everyone benefits. Unfortunately, our nation has lost much of its moral foundation. Would you agree? It's been a struggle. It doesn't matter who's in the administration, what's going on, all the parts of culture, we've lost our moral boundaries and our moral directions. But we must never lose hope. We must never stop praying. God can turn us around just like he did for the people there in Judah when Asa came to power. There was hopelessness prior to that. They had a king leading them in the wrong direction, but God turned it around, and God can do the same for us. Revival is not just what you get rid of. It's also what you pursue. I want you to notice in verse 4, and he commanded Judah to seek the Lord. It's not just about getting rid of the false gods. We need to seek the true God. We commanded Judah to seek the Lord, the God of our fathers, and to keep the law and the commandment. God ought to be the pursuit of our hearts. His word is what gives us instruction and direction and understanding and wisdom. We need God. He also took out all the cities of Judah, the high places and the incense altars, and the kingdom had rest under him. You know, sometimes I feel like there's a lot of anxiety in our culture. I was reading just an article the other day. I sent it to some of the members of my family, just noticing that teenage anxiety is at the highest it's been on record. And they're trying to figure out why. Is alcohol and drug abuse up? No, not necessarily. It ought to go down, but it's still pretty constant from what it was decades before. You know, well, is it, you know, just inappropriate activity? It's not any higher or less than it was before. The one indicator, they said, is the connection to cell phones, smartphones, social media, and the pressures that the world continues to have. The access to the world has added more anxiety to our students who are growing up. Suicide rate is higher now than it ever has been among teenagers. You know, remember when you were growing up, if something bad happened at school, it might get back to home by the time you get there, but you didn't have worldwide information at your fingertips. At 9 a.m. in the morning, you weren't able to just pull up anything that you want to at any point. And we got third graders who have access to the world in their hands, and they're anxious. Something bad happens in Venezuela. They can know about it if they desire to know about it, or it just comes across their social media, and then they start worrying, is that going to happen to me today? You know, there's a school shooting down in Florida, and every teenager in America is immediately anxious, thinking the shooter's about to walk into their school. They have access to so much information. It adds so much pressure, so much difficulty. Perhaps we need to begin to lead as the church, showing students and other people in the world, if we would seek the Lord and His commandments, we may have rest in our land. That we have so much going on, and we can't even control it. But rather than, like Peter, who's walking across the Sea of Galilee, walking to Jesus, and he began to sink. When he stopped his focus on the Lord. He's walking. He's like, oh, this is great. I'm walking on water. Oh, no, the winds and the waves, they've distracted me. It looks too big for me. And he begins to lose faith, and he begins to sink. That's what's going on in our culture. We're sinking as a nation or as a world because our focus is on all the winds and the waves when we ought to be focused on Jesus Christ, the peace that he brings. And they had the right leadership in this time period. He commanded Judah to seek the Lord, the God of our fathers, and keep the law and the commandments. And under that, he has rest. Verse 6, he built fortified cities. You know, he putting walls around in Judah, for the land had rest. He had no wars during these years, these first 10 years, for the Lord gave him peace. Verse 7, and he said to Judah, let us build these cities and surround them with walls and towers and gates and bars. The land is still ours, because we have sought the Lord our God. You realize what's happening here. It's not even about what they're building. It's about who they believe in. We have sought him, and he has given us peace on every side. So they built and prospered. I mean, Asa was a young man in hot pursuit of the Lord. Man, I wish we had more of that in our country. More young people raising up going, I don't care what the world says. I desire to pursue.